Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Can everybody hear me okay?
No.
You can't hear? Is it not working?
I don't think it's working.
It's working over here.
It's not working.
I'm not close enough. Okay, how's this? Okay. Hi, good afternoon, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. Today is Tuesday, April 11th, 2017. It is 3:30 p.m., and this is panel 2755, Is America Waging a War on Women? My name is Erica Stutzman, and I'll be your moderator today. We are going to be using the app, if you wanted to use the app to submit questions. If not, please just raise your hand, and the producers will get a note card to you that they'll bring to me, and we'll ask the questions. I personally think that this is a really interesting year to be asking this question. So I think that we'll have a lot of crowd involvement. I will do some introductions, and then we'll go through some bios. Anita Sarkeesian is a media critic and the creator of executive director of Feminist Frequency, a nonprofit that explores the representations of women in pop culture narratives. Her work focuses on deconstructing the stereotypes associated with women in popular culture, as well as highlighting issues surrounding the targeted harassment of women in online and gaming spaces, and she lives in San Francisco. Florence Williams is the author of The Nature Fix, Why Nature Makes Us Happier, Healthier, and More Creative, and Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History, winner of the 2013 Los Angeles Times Book Prize. She's a contributing editor of Outside Magazine and a freelance writer for the New York Times, New York Times Magazine, National Geographic, and other publications. She is also a writer and host of the new Audible original podcast, Breasts Unbound. She lives with her family in Washington, D.C. Heather Hansen is a performer, performative and visual artist known for her kinetic drawings. She has performed and exhibited in major cities throughout Asia, Europe, and the U.S. Her kinetic drawings series, a hybrid of dance, film, and visual art, utilizes the body as a drawing tool to transcribe movement to canvas. Hansen currently lives in New Orleans, and for those of you who are interested in art and performance, you should go to her website. It's really cool. It's heatherhansen.net. And last but not least, Shadia Maraban is a journalist, translator, activist, and mediator, as well as an advocate for an increased role in women in peace efforts and post-conflict management. She is currently working as a consultant for the Mediators Beyond Borders International and also part of the United Nations Development Program Expres, which is the expert roster for rapid response. I'm sure I butchered that. She is based in Indonesia. Thank you very much. I know I'm on the center guest Wi-Fi, which is working fine if you want to try that out. If not, please raise your hand for questions, and now we will go through and do some introductions. Anita?
Do our bit.
Yeah, do your bit.
So I had panels back to back, and I have no idea what anyone else is going to talk about, so this will be fun. So the answer to the question is yes. Thank you. on November 9th, of 2016, 13 women woke up and found that their rapist was president of the United States. So yes, the U.S. is waging a war on women and has for a very long time. I think there are so many different ways to approach this topic, which I'm really curious to see how everyone takes this. I'm going to talk super briefly about online harassment because I think that fits really well here, and it is something I know very well. We are seeing online harassment has existed for as long as online has existed, and I think it's one of the ways in which women and marginalized folks are being attacked directly online for speaking up, for challenging the status quo, for challenging power, for being activists, for existing, for merely showing that they exist, and the most marginalized voices are the ones that are not getting the attention needed. So women of color, trans women, etc. And the harassment, you know, when Trump was elected, The reason I'm talking about this is because I've been the target of an online harassment campaign since 2012. And this is everything from death and rape threats to bomb threats at the events that I speak at to pornographic images in my likeness to contacting the FBI and the IRS saying that I'm a con artist, which is hilarious. I can't imagine what it's like to be the person getting those reports and being like, what? To doxing, which is to collect and publicly distribute your personal information online, and often with the doxing comes death threats and rape threats. So there's so many different tactics that are used to attack people, specifically marginalized people online. So one of the things that I do with Feminist Frequency is I advocate to end online harassment. I work with social media companies to change their policies and change their product to make it harder to do that. And I think that this is one of the new strategies and tactics, new-ish, right? It's been ramped up over the last several years to go after these voices. And so when Trump was elected, I got asked a lot to speak about online harassment and Gamergate, which was this large-scale attack against women in and around the gaming industry that started with Zoe Quinn, who's a game developer, and her ex-boyfriend wrote this like lying screed about how she slept with all these reviewers to get positive reviews on her game, which is all lies, and it started this enormous campaign of hate and harassment against women in and out of the industry, which caused a lot of women to leave the industry and to stop working in it because it got so vitriolic. So when I was asked to do all these interviews about Gamergate, which is this niche gaming thing, and like the election of the president of the United States of America, I was like, oh my God, are you serious right now? Like, what? Let's put this into context. But the strategies were the same. The strategies that the harassers used against us in and around the gaming industry are the same strategies that are used to get Trump elected, right? The means that were used online to demonize his opponents or to prop him up were used. The kind of backlash sentiment that happened around the elections in terms of, you know, one of the ways that he got elected was to blame women and people of color and Islam and terrorists and all of these big, horrible boogeymen that aren't real, that aren't the real problem. And the same thing happened in games, right? Women were accused of all of these things that they weren't accused of. And it was this backlash to progress, right? That we're seeing progress in and around the games industry. We are seeing small-scale progress in our society as marginalized folks are becoming more visible and having more positions of power, and we're seeing the backlash against that. And so, I guess I'll just leave it at that, and I think that the conversation we'll have is really interesting. I just wanted to put that perspective on one of the tactics that's used against women to silence us and make us step down from our work.
Thank you, Anita, for doing that. Those of us who are online, it does feel like a threatening space. So appreciate your work. I have a little bit of historical perspective, I guess. I looked up the phrase war on women, and I guess it really started getting a lot of traction in around 1992 when Susan Faludi wrote her book Backlash, The War Against Women. She was, in fact, sort of anticipating, you know, what we would see for the coming decades. And at the time, I was frankly a little bit skeptical. I grew up in the 80s. I come from a long line of very kind of independent professional women. My great-grandmother was a widow. She became a lace merchant. My grandmother was an attorney. My mother was a psychologist. And I kind of had bought into this sort of feminist triumphalist narrative, you know, after the 70s, which was that things were really getting better. And it seemed like they were, you know, in my family and, you know, hopefully in other people's families. But, you know, Susan Faludi wrote this book in 1989. You know, there was a wake-up call. I participated in the March for Reproductive Rights in Washington, D.C. at that time. So there was already a sense in 1989 that Roe v. Wade was in trouble. This was, what, 17 years after, about. And certainly since that time, the war against women has taken on this connotation of being kind of the Republican war against reproductive freedoms. And sure enough, you know, that has happened. It's much harder to get an abortion now, to have access to contraception, even than it was when I was in college. So here are some of the statistics of what's been going on. Threats and violence at abortion clinics are at a 20-year high. There are at least 17 states where you cannot effectively get access to the abortion pill. What else? There's actually a fairly long line. Oh, well, I mean, so Roe v. Wade was really supposed to make it so that you didn't have to cross state lines to get an abortion. And now all of a sudden, boom, you really do. I mean, there are stretches of Texas where there is not an abortion clinic for 550 miles. There's not funding for women to have access to abortion. We're seeing an erosion of insurance assurances for even things like contraception. So we certainly do seem to be in the middle of kind of an assault on reproductive freedom. I thought I would end with just a little story of the fifth generation of feminists in my family, and that is my 13-year-old daughter. So, you know, this is sort of a tale of how, you know, we shouldn't just blame the Republicans, right, for the war against women. So we live in Washington, D.C. 94% voted for Hillary Clinton. You know, I feel like we're living in kind of a sweet liberal bubble in some ways in D.C., much like Boulder. She goes to a sweet little school. She has been very politicized by this election, as many, I think, preteens and teens have been. We marched on Washington in the Women's March a couple months ago. She made her signs. She's become very politicized. She joined a club at school called We Are the 51. The 51% refers to the majority of women in the world, and it's really about creating sort of gender equity for women and that struggle, not just in the United States, but elsewhere. You know, 6 months into her school year, her history teacher who leads that, a man who leads that club, was arrested for soliciting sex from a 14-year-old girl online. So, boy, that really prompted a lot of discussion and opportunity for even what's going on in our liberal bubbles. We still have, you know, an incredibly oppressive culture against women and how we treat women. So whether the phrase war against women is kind of perhaps a lightning rod, some people think it's an exaggeration. It makes it easy for critics to say, oh, you're just exaggerating. It certainly feels at times like there is a physical threat to our well-being, and it feels like an assault. So something to think about.
All right. Good afternoon. I'm not American, but I can give a perspective from my experience and working in the international arena. I think many of us forgot that all of the struggle that we have been working for the last, I don't know, the struggle of women for votes and gender equality, we've been doing that for the last, maybe in the United States, more than 100 years, and in my place, probably less than 50 years. However, I think it is, again, about power dynamics. It is about getting who are in power. If you look at the recent case of the impeachment of Korean president, for example, Park Geun-hye, and also the Brazilian president, Dilma Rousseff, on the accusation of corruption, the emphasis of what we see on the news is more about her being a woman, not so much about the case. Dilma Rousseff is an icon, is an example of a woman in Brazil and how she won the election democratically. However, something happened along the way, and when she fought for it, you know, it doesn't seem that the media or the even international and women in general are helping her in terms of getting her name back, you know, besides the corruption case. And then we have also Park Geun-hye. Another interesting story is that the culture different in every parts of the world, I guess in Korea, in Brazil, Indonesia, and Myanmar. Myanmar is one of the places I work, and probably most of you have heard of Aung San Suu Kyi. She is a very great prominent leader. She spent 25 years pressuring the military government to bring democracy for Myanmar and 15 years of house arrest. But currently, if you look at the progress in Myanmar, is democratically, they're not so much different during the military junta, because she's not speaking up against the minorities refugees, such as the Rohingyas refugees and others who are living under discrimination and poverty in Myanmar. So at the end, from the international perspective, you would see, can she deliver? Can she really bring justice and democracy and gender equality? Because many of the women who are in power, I work in a development situation where women are elected, they tend not to promote the gender equality as they're supposed to be, you know, because all of them are acting like they are there because they're capable. You know, it's true that they are capable, but it's at the same time we need individuals also to support, and we need government to support. We can't, as women, I don't think we can fight our fights alone. We have to work together. We have to work with men, we have to work with individuals, we have to work with civil society, we have to work with a lot of leaders, inspiration leaders in this world to promote what we call gender equality and justice. I think many of us see this on a different perspective, and each race have different narratives, different culture, different understanding about gender equality. But we see it differently. For example, in the United States, when we see the Women's March, we were so happy, you know, like finally there is this kind of movement in the United States. But then there are some other elements as well. People felt that many of this March movement was kind of a hijack with other issues coming in. This is from the international perspective, not me as Shadia speaking, you know, because I know I've been coming in and out of the United States, but I was in Thailand, I was in Myanmar, and these people talk about, like, what is this march really meant for the women, and what is really meant for changing the democratic system in the United States? I couldn't answer that. So I think, you know, we are here to understand that maturing democracy also requires some kind of other elements. And here I put three steps for not only fighting on gender equality and justice, but also building a stronger community. They needed the support of individuals, government people, building a stronger family support, because we think we can do this by ourselves. No, we need mother, father, brother, sister. We need to move and to teach our children, like what you said, you teach your 13-year-old, and I teach my son also to cook and clean, you know, to do things what women do, so he won't feel ashamed of doing things, housework, you know. Also build strong economic improvement on women. And I see on my part of the world, you know, poverty is always linked to women. You know, and we have this movement, for example, in Bangladesh with the Grameen Bank, and others movement in India, you know, with the investment, banking investment. I think this is what we need to do. We need to relate this work together. We need to work harder, because a women bank, we never think of a women bank. You know, a women institute, financial institution that can support women all over the world, that can connect women. We never think of building an apps to help women all over the world to struggle, to strive, to make their life a little bit easier. I think this is something not only symbolically, but it's an ambition. And I think this is what future should be look like for the next generation. So men and women, whoever work in the computer industries, or they should think about doing this type of efforts. I would say that the last one, we can't fight a new war with an old weapon, because this is a new war. So I think we need a new strategy, a grand strategy. We need a new weapons and ammunition. That's what we need to do. And we can't do the 70 style. We have to move forward. We have to get things done from the roots. Bottom-up process, no more top-down. We need to do bottom-up process, building the resilient community, building understanding in our, you know, family support system. And I think focus on that for a balanced movement in the future. Thank you very much.
The answer to my question is it's in the question. And yes, there is a war on women. I'm not sure if it's a gender, as in men against women, war on women, as much as it is as policy and even women within at war with each other. And I guess what I want to start with my upbringing, which was in a very conservative, religious family, and while we were taught a lot of skills in the world to be entrepreneurial and self-sufficient, there was an undertone of being submissive, you know, and feminism was kind of a dirty word in my household growing up. So it took me some time to embrace the word feminism, to find my voice, creatively, and took a lot of travel and a lot of experimentation to kind of bust out of that mentality. And I think about this election, how traumatic it was for me personally, for my son, who is 19. He came of age during the Obama years, so he was very idealistic and very excited to vote this first time. And election night, he's texting me, you know, oh no, no. And my heart is just sinking because I think I was not that surprised, honestly. I grew up in a conservative family. This is nothing terribly new to me, but I've raised him quite differently. So, you know, to see his idealism get shattered, it was really hard on me too. And he came home that night from work and just was sobbing. And then I was crying. You know, we're holding each other, and I realized he's just terrified for the future. And I appreciate his innocence in that way. It's in a way, that's a privilege which I didn't have. I never assumed that a person like Trump would not get elected, you know. So when it comes to are we at war, I think this is an old war. Are we still at war is really the question. And I think about this headline that this article I read a few years back in the Huffington Post, and it said that women need several hours more of sleep per evening because we're so exhausted fighting the patriarchy. It's tongue-in-cheek, but it's so true. You know, it is exhausting, and it's something we live with on a daily basis. It's not always in your face so much as it's a push, you know. The wage gap, the sexism. I can just go on and on. I won't get deeply into that. We'll wait for questions, but that's my personal take on this.
So we have some great questions already. One of them stems to the women's marches in general. And there has been a critique, and you don't have to agree with this, but the critique has come up that it's not a very inclusive movement right now, in particular with the women's marches, that we were seeing a lot of people of means finally mad for maybe the first time. People of color didn't feel as included. People who are transgender didn't feel as included. And so I wondered if any of you can address some of that, the inclusiveness.
I can answer that.
Sure.
After the election, I went to the march in Washington. I just felt very compelled to do that and drove up with a group of, strangers from New Orleans, one friend, and the rest of the car was strangers. We all just felt like we needed to go. And all the way there and all the way back, we listened to the news and we listened to podcasts and I got a lot of different perspectives on the march. And the same day, I went to the African American Museum, which was just amazing. And there was something important about seeing that museum on that day, where you feel this power of, you know, millions of women actually not battling each other, coming together for a common cause. But then going to this museum, and I just, you know, this is a warlike country, and we are a country built on inequality and slavery, and it's really important to understand, I guess, our karma as a country. And I don't think we can resolve racism without addressing sexism, but they are very much intertwined.
It did strike me at the march, actually, that there were lots of different people of color. There were, I went with my 80-year-old dad. There were old people, there were young people. It was probably the most sort of diverse march, really, that that I've seen or participated in. Part of that is just the nature of Washington, D.C. But I don't think there are really a lot of feminists out there today who are not aware, you know, of this deep criticism, you know, of the history of the women's movement and of feminism, and its failure, you know, to be inclusive. I think we're sort of at a crossroads now, where because there is this awareness of the so-called intersectionality of the movement, it feels different to me now, and I'm optimistic.
I think that it is a criticism that came out of communities that were the most affected, and that it's really important to listen to that. And I think in some ways, this is a much bigger issue than just the Women's March, right? And not to trivialize that, I think there's a lot of folks from communities of color and trans communities that came to the march because they wanted to participate but still also felt excluded. And so that there was a bit of both of that happening in the same space. And the reason I want to just bring it out a little bit is that, you know, let's not forget that. But the percentage of white women that voted for Trump is very real, right? What was it, like 50-something? 53%. That's not nothing. That is 53% of white women who voted for their race, who voted to maintain whiteness as opposed to voting for progress. Well, sorry, I don't want to say that because I'm not a white woman, but who voted based on their race as opposed to voting based on their gender. And I think that is not nothing. And when we look at even our feminist movements, the criticisms of white feminism are very real because too often in a lot of these communities that are very dominated by white women, they ignore the intersectionality that has been fought for so long now to make our movements and our feminist movements intersectional. And it doesn't mean that white women can't be a part of the movement. It just means that we have to understand that intersectionality actually means to look at all of the different intersections and how they impact our lives. So the levels of privilege and oppression that we have at the same time. And, you know, this also varies from place to place. So my colleagues, depending on where they live, have different experiences with this. So a white cis friend of mine, I had someone come up to me at a panel afterwards asking me what cis meant, so I'm just going to clarify that. Cis means that you were born with the same gender identity in which the gender in which you were assigned at birth is the gender in which you identify. So I was assigned female at birth, and I identify as female currently. So she's a white cis woman that lives in a Midwest conservative town, and when she brought up on her local, you know, Women's March group, that there needs to be more space held for women of color and the issues around that specifically, and what are they going to do about it? And they said, well, if that's a concern for you, then why don't you just start your own little caucus thing? Like, that's unacceptable in 2017 to say in any feminist space, in anywhere really, but in the U.S., right? So I think that there are valid concerns that need to be addressed and that we continually need to be having these conversations. And those of us with the most white privilege and those of us with the most cis privilege and all of the privileges have to continually speak up to the other people who are not taking this seriously or not being inclusive in our movements.
Okay, great. Well, you anticipated a crowd question, which was the majority of white women who voted for Donald Trump. I wonder if we can get really uncomfortable here and talk about women's roles in suppressing women, and also talk about Hillary, because you said you're not a fan. So let's talk about a little bit about how the country reacted to her and how that sort of race went, and even if there were the Bernie or bust people or all the other things that came into play with Hillary as sort of this polarizing figure. We'll start with you.
Sure, we can have that conversation, and I'm not going to say not to, but I don't think that that's the most useful conversation necessarily on this panel, because the reality is that white men are making decisions for our bodies. The reality is that patriarchy is what is dictating what we can and can't do. The reality is that it is cis men who are attacking us and making it so that we don't get to be full human beings. So yes, 100% women buy into patriarchy. We grew up in the same general culture, I guess, ish, as a broad statement, and I think it's important to really remember that. And so while having conversations about internalized oppression and talking about the ways that women attack other women is totally valid, let's not get too bogged down in that, because it's a little bit over here when the reality is we are being attacked by, and I'm saying attacked, and I don't think the war on women is an exaggeration in terms of the language, although I do get that it's alienating. But so part of me is hesitant to even go down that road, because like, let's keep our eye on the prize, so to speak, right? Like, let's focus on who is actually battling us.
I guess I would say that I think blaming white women for the election results buys into the classic sort of blaming women. I mean, a lot of people voted for Trump, and they voted because of their economic self-interest, or they were convinced that this was their economic self-interest. A lot of white women say that, what they care about most is their wallet. A lot of people are hurting out there. So I just think we have to be careful not to sort of like totally blame women. I mean, you could pick apart this election, which was really won on 140,000 votes in three states, and you could blame a lot of different categories. So I'm not sure the finger pointing, is all that useful.
Yeah, I think blaming on women is also, it's very classic. However, I think what makes Trump become a president is actually the system that the United States had for almost 240 years, this whatever system that you were having. Because in other parts of the world, if you have 3 million, popular votes, you win. I mean, I don't understand this here. I come from a place where vote means you get, either whatever. Anyway. So the system is also problematic. I think the struggle needs to be together in terms of building a system where we can be in this situation again in the future.
So I got a really great question on inclusivity that he or she does not remember that there was any criticism when the Million Man March happened, that it wasn't being inclusive enough. And why is it, do you think, that women are always responsible for the caretaking of everyone except for maybe their own interests? It's unsigned, but it's
a good one. Good one.
Although I seriously doubt there were no criticisms. So why is it that women are always responsible for caretaking everyone except for perhaps their own selves? Like, I think that that's the antithesis of feminism. Right, like the idea of feminism is about liberating everyone, right? This isn't about just women. This is about people of all genders, of all backgrounds. Like, feminism has always, well, it should sort of theoretically have always been about the liberation of everyone. And so that the saying of we are not free until everyone is free is very much at least a core tenet of the feminism that I subscribe to. So I don't think that acknowledging the existence and the humanity of all women is caretaking. And if it is caretaking, I'm down. Like, I'm down to be a caretaker.
I think women just have to fight harder, you know. I remember even I'm experiencing myself, you know, as a advisor, you know, even working at a higher level at the United Nations, you know, for example. And still that doubt, you know, because you're a woman. And they were waiting for the consultant, you know. And I said, I am the one. And you look at me like, are you serious? You know, I experienced that thousands of times. But you know what? That makes me stronger. I don't want to feel bad of myself. You know, I use that as a power in me that I can gain, you know, that I can learn more, even understand more. I make more friends by being, you know, sort of a small little fighter, you know. So I think it's really in you. And I don't want to see it in differently. I think in other parts of the world, you know, I give an example recently, a one-child policy in China, for example. I mean, you have all this freedom here, the same like in my country, Indonesia. But imagine, you know, there's an enforcement to have only one child for how many years in China? And that's a torture, I mean, for some families. And also in other parts of the world where you can't do any sort of health screening or reproductive health for women. So there's good and bad in anything. I think we just have to agree to some kind of balance. But I mean, in the situation where we have this new administration with some sort of belittling women, you know, and putting down with his own words, I think we need to fight differently. I think, you know, we have to do it in a way where everyone in this country can understand that, you know, the gender equality is for all of us. It's not only for women, but for all of us.
What are the new weapons that we could use in fighting this new war? And I also have a follow-up question. Are there tactics that the other side has brought to the table that women and women's advocates could use against the other side?
Well, you know, I think the question is giving yourself a... Let's look at this way. Let's look at this political situation in the U.S. It's a blessing in disguise. I hate to say that, but let's do it that way. So that we can move on and we know how to measure our success. We don't repeat the same failure. We don't do it, you know, again and again and we fail. We have to succeed. In some way, we need that grand strategy. And the weapons is really what you have here as a tool, whether it's a constitution, whether it's on the system that is no longer applicable, you know, for the 21st century. And whatever that you think that's increasing capacity of women, not only in the realms of freedom of speech and freedom of expression, but also political participation. It is increasingly important for people. Let's not focus only on the leadership. What I mean, political participation, I mean, even in a small town, you can make a lot of changes. Even in small village in my area, you know, if women take role, then we will make a change in the village. We will make a change in the community and then in the society. But again, women fights cannot be alone. We are strong, but we need help. We need help because this is how the world is being designed, like what Anita said. This is the world of patriarchy. We still fight maybe in the next 500 years. However, things will change if we do it differently.
Does anybody else want to address this question? What sort of tactics that we should be using for women and women's advocates?
I mean, I want to start with, you know, raise better men and date better men. It's a good place to start. You know, and we set our price. We set what we're going to accept or not accept. And I think that's the most important place to start. And, you know, war doesn't have to be negative or evil or violent. It can be, it can be very positive. I look at my son's attitudes and I can't keep up with his feminism. He's just far beyond me. You know, the way he thinks about all of these issues is really fascinating to me. And I think that's the goal every generation, to, in my perspective, is getting a little more progressive in their thinking about gender. And I think it's important as women to look at all the ways that the patriarchy or the patriarchal system is in some way benefiting you, and to wean yourself however you can in whatever small ways, and find ways to not keep it going, you know?
So one thing that I think that I don't think it's a new war. I think it's a very, very old war. It's the same one that's been fought for a long time. And I was just, the panel that I came here late from was an art exhibit at the museum here that showed these caricatures of women who, it was used to degrade them, right? So like in these really awful positions or really grotesque bodies. And it was these like, so that's, that was in the 18th, 19th century, and it's still the same shit that we have today, right? But I do 100% agree that we do need new strategies, and what do those look like? In addition to that, when Trump was elected, a lot of white men in my life all of a sudden really cared in a way that they never did before because they were never affected. And so there's that awesome, like, join us. Like, there's a huge sort of process of politicization that's happening right now, which is very similar to the feelings that I had around when George Bush was elected, right? That when we went to war, that there's this, like, politicization in the air where people really got involved. But welcome. We've been here for a while. And I think one of the things that I thought about a lot during this time is that there have been activist movements for a very long time, new and young, that have been doing amazing work to challenge power, right? To challenge, to fight for environmental justice, to fight for reproductive justice, to fight for immigrant rights. And so how do we not ignore the work that has already been done, that is continuing to be done, that just wasn't on our radar because we weren't paying attention? How do we plug into those movements in respectful ways, understanding the long history and the work that's been going on through Obama, through Bush, through for such a long time? And what are, like, what are the young people doing, right? Like, I think that young people lead our movements, and we need to not sort of be ageist in that process of understanding that, like, it might look weird to us, but they're the ones who are leading the revolution in a lot of ways.
I read an article recently with some really disturbing statistics in it. Was asking millennial men whether they believed that a wife should be a stay-at-home mom. And it compared those answers to, 20 years ago. And the number of millennial men who agree with that statement, that women should be stay-at-home moms, is actually almost double what it was 20 years ago. I know.
It was like 18 to 23-year-olds or something like
that. Yeah. So, you know, wow, right? And so I think that really gets to Hannah's point that, you know, one of our greatest weapons is culture, and culture really starts at home. And I think that, you know, kids have to have role models for how to be men and women, how to be in a relationship, how to treat each other. And I just, I commend you so much for having a 19-year-old feminist boy. That's where I think it has to start.
What do you see as some of the characterizations or personality traits of men who fear women in power? Don't say what you're thinking.
I know.
Well, I think we have a whole government full of them. You know, I mean, I don't think you have to look far, you know, to see what those traits are, because they're on display. I mean, every time Trump signs a bill, he's surrounded by a bunch of white men. And that's it, you know.
Is it loss of economic power, loss of political might, change in the status quo, reproductive scariness? What? a little bit of a, okay, I thought it was good. Thank you for asking it. Oh, okay. I'm going to read this just as it's written. Do you think that women's marches feed into the ideas that women are hot-headed and emotional? How effective are they really?
Are they as in women?
I think marches.
Marches.
Oh, that's a little infuriating. I mean, you know, the history of political activism in this country has been in the streets, right? And it hasn't always been women being hot-headed. And there were a lot of emotional men who, you know, wrote things like Common Sense and forged the American Revolution. I just saw Hamilton. He was hot-headed. So, I think that's kind of a non-starter.
When if you look at my Twitter feed, it's all dudes freaking out
that I exist.
You are the one talking about emotional. You know, I think it's worth having conversations around what marches are for and what the strategies, like why we have them. And I think one of the most important parts of marching, which is not the only strategy we have and certainly cannot be the only strategy, is that it riles up the base. It reminds you that there are other people with you. The energy of being in a space with other people who are like-minded and fighting for justice is not nothing. And so I think we can't erase or ignore the fact that it is inspiring to see that. It's also encouraging to other women who don't feel like they have a voice to see other women, or other, you know, whoever is fighting whatever social movement it is. And that's really valuable, and I don't think we should erase the value of energizing ourselves and keeping us going in these long-term movements. And also, like, fuck you for calling women hot-headed. Like, that's just straight-up sexist. Not you, the question asker, but, like, the people who say that. I will be very, very angry that I don't have the same rights, or that we live in a system that constantly crushes and puts down anybody, right, and to any degree. And so, yeah, I will scream and yell until I'm blue in the face. And you'd want to call me angry, go for it, because I am.
I think many of these statements are also came from women, and that's what makes it difficult. However, I think the women's, well, we have to go beyond marches, you know. I don't want to say revolution, but it's sort of that way in a milder, you know, arena. How can we do that, you know, in just not putting women in the box, you know, but just doing it as a responsibility tools as all citizens, you know, as all, because the way I see it, if we do it just women, you know, and it may seem like that's why, oh, that's just angry women, you know, but if we do it all, you know, men, women, and whatever color, you know, and be more a little bit inclusive of the process, I think we can be better, you know, and successful in this fight. So we have to think beyond marches.
Do you know about this? In Iceland, there was the Day Without Women protest, and I think that's a really effective. In Iceland, there was a protest called the Day Without Women. I think it was in the 70s. I don't remember the date, but it effectively shut down the country for that day. Women just didn't go to work and didn't raise their children. They left that work to their husbands and the men. And while the pay gap is not completely closed there, they're far ahead of us, and I think taking those kind of actions are pretty effective, as effective as marching, right, in addition to.
How much of a role does religion play in oppression of women?
Okay.
You said it.
Yeah. I think everyone looks at me, right? Okay. Well, I think... Depends on how you looked at it, you know. There are some elements in the religion that completely, you know, block, you know, some these women coming up, you know, to show herself, you know. However, there are also some positive things. So we have to look at these things in a balanced way. We can't be too extreme. We can't do this both hot and this side is hotter. You know, we have to balance it with hot and cold and see it from the perspective of culture, tradition, and norms in every religion in a country. I mean, growing up in a place where a little bit conservative, I would say, but my parents are not blocking me or stopping me from being what I want. You know? He always say, you can be what you want, you know, just be yourself. And I think that really give a confidence, but he is always with me, and he always supports me. And I think without his support, I can't reach what I am now, you know. So I think his support meant a lot. So I may grow up in that conservative family. However, he gave me a lot of confidence for me to study, you know, to achieve what I want to do, to grow, to travel, you know. And so that kind of give me a confidence to become a woman in a sense of understanding religion, culture, tradition, and norms. And I think I don't want to exaggerate the role of religion, but it is somehow in some parts of the world did have an impact, in particular if it's combined with culture or tradition, you know, like if female genital mutilation, people thought that's Islam, because that's actually a practice in Africa where people are doing this kind of practice. And in different parts of the world, different Christian denominations, also in Indonesia, where it's a little bit scary if you learn about their understanding, you know. And so other parts of the world, there are many stories of these. If you learn about culture, if you learn about other religion, the thing is to understand, to give space, to embrace, to learn different culture and different religion. And I think that's the beauty of who we are.
So this is another sort of perspective question, and it is that a very disliked female candidate lost the election, but she won the popular vote, but we still say that she's very disliked even though she won the popular vote. But how does this era even compare to the 80s when it was extremely controversial to put a woman on the Supreme Court? So do we want to talk about progress at all, or how some things have changed?
Yeah, I mean, I did run across some interesting kind of points. You know, there are some bright spots on the horizon. I mean, a lot of states, even at the same time, while they're, you know, restricting abortion access, they're actually increasing paid leave legislation. So we see that as something that's happening. Don't forget, it was women judges who granted stays against Trump's Muslim ban. So the courts do have a lot of women judges on them. They are wielding power. There are signs of progress out there. I look at Emily's List. You know, I'm from D.C. They have a whole campaign now, you know, that is teaching women how to run for office, and they're teaching them how to fundraise. They're teaching them how to give speeches, teaching them how to, form sort of grassroots activist organizations. And I thought this was really interesting. The Republicans have actually responded by teaching men, male candidates, how to fight women candidates. So the war continues.
Given that we are women, written by a woman, given that women are a majority of the world's population, why do you think we are even fighting this war? Why don't we just overthrow the horrid oppression?
We will.
Yeah. Working on it.
So what do you think is holding us back from obvious progress? Or from faster progress, maybe I should say.
Patriarchy. Culture.
Yeah. the nuts and bolts of childbearing, take you out of that game a little bit, you know? And the fact that that's just an assigned, gender role for women, you know? But it does take a tremendous amount of your time and energy.
Yeah, and like that's a part of, I think that that's a part of the system of patriarchy that designates that women are child rearers, and that's their role and caregiving and all that. Like, I think changing cultural systems and changing social systems is really, really hard, especially when you have constant resistance to it, right? And both in terms of, yes, that you, when you have constant resistance to it. And so part of the challenge is that, like, we're literally trying to change centuries of established norms. Like, it doesn't happen overnight. And yeah, like, I think we'd all like to see progress happen way faster than it is. And sometimes it feels like we're going backwards, and in a lot of ways we are. But I think, right, like, one of the big things we have to do is change culture. And that doesn't mean, like, knocking on everyone's door and being like, stop being shitty. It means that we have to, like, change the systems in which we operate, and then people change within those systems. So, for example, like, in the civil rights movement, it's not like black folks knocked on every white person's door and said, stop being racist. That's not how change happened. They changed the laws, which then changed the systems, which forced people to behave differently. Now, we can talk about how our we still live under white supremacy, but there is a very clear difference in the 60s and now, right? And I think it's important to understand that, like, we need to build the critical mass to create these changes and to celebrate the wins that we get, right? Don't ignore the little bits. Sorry, just one more thing. I'm really glad that there's an international perspective on this panel, because most of my other panels have not had that and have been very white. And right after the election, I was in Sweden. And I was like, oh my God, everything's the worst where we have to, blah, blah. And I was like, oh my God, we are so ethnocentric in the U.S. Like, we are freaking out when this shit is happening everywhere. Like, across the West, there's a rise in fascism, there's a rise in Nazi parties, in white supremacy. I refuse to use alt-right because I don't want to normalize it as something that's, like, cool and has a name like that. It's just straight-up Nazis. And it's not just us, right? So I, at the same time that I was in Sweden, I was also on a panel, I have no idea why I was on this panel, of international female journalists who, like, risk their lives to get stories and are, like, banned from countries and, like, get smuggled in to, like, to interview people. And I was like, oh, people, like, women around the world have been dealing with these issues that we are now freaking out about, right? So how do we, one, work together? How do we take cues from women who have already gone through these struggles or are going through these struggles and realize that this isn't just something happening in the U.S. that, like, is very much across the West?
I love that description of those journalists, and it reminds me that we need to foster bravery in girls. There's actually a bravery gap. If you ask kids, you know, do you feel brave? Way more boys say yeah than girls, and I think that's quite interesting. And it totally translates into how much they will challenge, you know, culture and patriarchy as they age. You know, there are self-esteem issues that are certainly, I think, amplified by social media, by images in popular culture. As a parent, I know that these are really challenging, hard to combat, and we have to start with fostering and instilling bravery in our girls, too.
I love that. We made a series called Ordinary Women, Daring to Defy History that told the stories of women who've been written out of history, and a couple of the activists that we profiled was Emma Goldman and Ida B. Wells, and, like, these were not women that people liked, right? But they're the women who sustained the erasing of women through history, right? Like, it's the most obnoxious, the most vocal, the most persistent voices that make big, meaningful change, right? And so this idea that we're training women and young girls to be submissive or quiet or to not
smile all the time,
to not disrupt, to not interrupt, and to not be, you know, like, so that's not how you make change in the world.
So at least one man in the audience wants me to ask you, and it's more than one because they've all asked it in different ways, but one man wants you three to tell, or you four, to tell the rest of the men in the audience what they should do to help.
Okay.
Listen. And you're here listening.
Yeah.
So great.
Work with us. You know, I think working together, empowering each other, you know, don't think because you're a man you're smarter or better, but you probably are, but we can learn, understand each other, you know, but in this fight, you know, because it's been an ongoing fight. We need that big grand strategy, as I mentioned, but we need to work more closely. I think now we need to work more closely with men and champion. Champion means men who are supporting women, you know, in empowering them. And also working together, you know, working together in building a stronger community, supporting women. I take an example for on Syrian refugees, you know. Many of us, when we look at the picture of Syrian refugees, we as women, who, you know, I work mostly with refugees as well, and why don't we think about providing home, you know, for the women, by the women? Don't you think that's a cool idea? And that's a global thing. So we have to think global. We can't, we no longer can think only in, you know, local thing. We should empower bottom up. However, we should also think globally. I mean, nobody in Syria wants to go to Europe. Believe me, it's cold in Sweden. Nobody wants to live in Finland, you know. And I met many of them, and they said, look, we don't want to go, but we have nowhere else to go. And these are women and children, babies, you know, little kids. And seeing this picture, you know, and we're seeing, like, how can we see these things happen and we don't do anything as women? And we think we fight for women, but we don't do anything for these restless refugees.
I think the question of how to be a good ally is a really tough one, which is very loaded. And having one, I think that it's the job of allies, whether it's about being, whether you're white or male or cis or straight or what have you, wealthy, is to talk to other people of that privilege, right? It is constantly put on those oppressed bodies to educate everyone else. And I think it's very much the job of allies to educate other people and have those uncomfortable conversations. So when someone says a sexist joke in, like, locker room talk, for example, that it's the job of men to say, hey, that's not cool, and to call it out. And education is really important. And so not coming up to your female friends and being like, teach me the history of feminism, and what do you think about all of these things? Like, go read a book, right? Like, actually do the research and read the writing of the tremendous amount of people who have been talking about intersectional feminist issues, global, whatever it is, whatever the issues are. So do the work to be a part of the movement and understand that you might get called out. We all do. We've all experienced that uncomfortable calling outness of saying something wrong, and that's a part of our growth and evolution, and you say sorry and don't do it again kind of thing. And in that same part of that is that I know a lot of people who have been burned by allies, who have been very much hurt by people who claim to be feminist, men who claim to be feminist, white folks who claim to be anti-racist, and understanding that that's the environment in which you're coming into and being a little compassionate to that and understanding of that, I think, makes you a better ally to folks if you really want to be a part of this fight.
Don't be a feminist in wolf's clothing. Yeah. I think that's something I've come across quite a bit, is men saying they're feminists, but then their actions speak otherwise. And I would say the greatest thing you can do probably is to seek therapy and read self-help books like women do, because we're tired of doing the emotionally heavy lifting for you all. And it's time to just carry your own weight that way. And that would go a long way to help.
This is primarily for Ms. Karsisian, but I think you could all address it in some ways. What do you think are some of the larger societal factors that propel primarily men to harass people online? Yeah, mostly you. But I think we've all seen it. I don't know any woman who hasn't.
I've had a lot of comments on my art that are incredibly sexist or sexual, just flat out, and I'm like, no, I'm not drawing a vagina, and why are you saying that? And why are you saying that? And that's just minor. I'm not getting death threats or anything, but you know, you can't even put a painting up online without expecting some kind of feedback like that.
What do you think it is about our culture that sort of is propelling that availability? Is it just technology? Is it anonymity? Is it
I
bigger?
Think that anonymity encourages cowardice like that. Yeah. That's my perspective.
I'm telling you, that this is in games specifically, but we see this when they get attacked across the board, that it is very much a sense of entitlement, that men believe that there are certain spaces that are just for them, and how dare women come into these spaces and exist in them and speak up about them. So for gaming, we've been like, yeah, we've been here forever, right? Like, we've been making games since they started, we've been playing games since they started, and this is apparently shocking to some men, and they don't think we should be around. And they have this very entitled perception of, like, we're taking their toys away. And they are reacting in these really aggressive ways when we're challenging the fact that, like, yeah, it is not okay that our games are full of sex objects constantly, for example. That women need to be presented, and, you know, as we're playing games, we need to be presented in equitable, respectful ways as well. And I think that part of this issue, you know, like, anonymity does play a role, but I actually think that when we focus on anonymity, we lose the larger context of how harassment happens. So, for example, I've gotten harassed by people on Facebook where it has their name and their places of work and the picture of them with their girlfriend, and you're like, wow, your girlfriend knew you were a shitbag. And so it's not always anonymous. And while it does exacerbate sometimes, it's just people are willing to be shitty non-anonymously, right? But that if you make the means of harassment easy, a lot of people will jump in. So, for example, Twitter's a really huge platform for harassment because it is so easy to do. One person makes some shitty, like, some crappy video about me talking about, like, defaming me and calling me a liar and sort of skirting the terms of service so that it can't be taken down or removed. But all of their followers just have to hit reply, and then I am inundated with a wave of harassment, right? You take out the ability to reply, and you drop one little tiny effort. It just makes it a little bit harder to harass, right? So it doesn't matter whether their faces are on it or not, because they're just like, dumb bitch, right? Or death threats, or what have you.
So we have time for one more question. I'm going to go ahead and pick one that is, how does this war end? What does the ending look like?
I spent a lot of time trying to imagine what a patriarchy-free society looks like. Yeah. And it's really, really hard because it's so ingrained in everything. I put that out there as, like, a really interesting thought experiment for folks who've never done that. Like, would buses look like they currently look?
Right?
Like, it's that granular.
I think we need to educate men in the sense of this realm. I mean, we need more men speaker, in fact, in this type of panel. Mm-hmm. See, even this type of designing, we need to rethink. When we talk about gender, all women panelists, why? You know, I'm sure there are men who wants to sit in here and talk about these type of issues, you know, and I've known many men who are willing to speak up, you know, not only on behalf of women, but also on behalf of men because of this type of behavior. The second thing, I think, is mostly in not only objectifying women as, you know, with their body and sexuality and things like that. You know, if you look at all these advertisement, you know, on TV, you know, there's nothing to do with a women's body, but they're showing it, you know, that's like, you're selling something, but then it's always like women half naked, you know, and doing all, and I think that sometimes also give, you know, it's good for marketing. Maybe they can get more attention, but it's without unconsciously, without realizing, it's also kind of putting, you know, women in that situation. You know, although maybe we need to rethink many of it. You know, and I think educating men also not doing all sorts of aggressive, you know, promotion, you know, aggressive thing on women. So I think we have to look it in a way where we can find some kind of balance situation where the critical mass can happen. Because without balance, one side might be look lower than the other, you know. So we have to do this in a balanced way where we can rise together. Because there are many also men who are, you know, in my part of the world, there are many men also who are struggling, you know, from economic poverty, for example. It's not always just gung-ho, strong man, you know, and do all this thing. But there are men who are also struggling. And many of these men are, they don't know what to do. You know, we have all sorts of training, for example, for women. I work for the UNDP. We have hundreds of thousands of dollars dedicated each year for gender training. But why many of these countries, you know, who are being trained on gender, you know, mainstreaming, none of them are really doing a good job, you know? So what is wrong with this? You know, and I happen to advocate some of them, you know, last year and this year, and I found it that because many of the women are overtrained. Because women are training women. Women are not training men. And this is the dilemma. You know, we think we're successfully training 400 women, taking pictures, send it to the UN, you know, oh, have fun. But we don't realize you teach the same 400 women next year and the same 400 women again next year. So you don't grow. These women basically overtrain. And they don't share with their community because they are putting themselves as the elite. Many of these NGO people were working in this non-government organization in some of the developing countries. They are putting themselves in the sort of elite class, looking down at the real problem in the society. You know, they have access to go to the U.S., they have visa to go to the United States, they have visa to go to Europe. But what about those women who are struggling with weak men in the villages and they have nowhere else to go? They don't know where to bring this issue. So I think educate men and also putting this common sense into a little bit balance. Thank you.
We have 2 minutes left if you guys can bear with me. How do you all work with women who don't feel oppressed? How do you bring them into the dialogue? And they're the women who are like, everything's fine. What are you mad about? March for what?
Stockholm syndrome. That's what I have to say. I think that if women who have that belief are sorry. We need to educate and reach out to women as well, not just to men. And it's a lot of work, but we can't just let those kind of attitudes go by, you know, uncalled out. So that's my perspective.
So just on the question before that, I wanted to quote Audre Lorde, the master's tools will never dismantle the master's house. So when we're talking about vision in terms of what is the end of this wolf life, I think it's really important that we reconceptualize power. That just getting a woman into the White House doesn't mean that all of our problems are fixed by any stretch of the imagination, and that all issues are women's issues. And all women's issues are all, well, whatever, anyways. I think it's really, what's one piece of this that is fundamental for us to remember is that our conceptions of power are rooted in these oppressive systems, so let's dismantle those concepts of power and reconceptualize them to be more humane, to be more about all genders and all races, et cetera, et cetera. So when we envision the future, what does that look like?
Very good. Thanks for everybody for coming.
No, please do. Well, I was just saying, when I, you know, back to my daughter, when I think of her future and what I wouldn't want for her in a more progressive future, it would be a place where she is physically safe and where she feels empowered, you know, economically and politically.